Carrie.
Alright, we're going to go ahead and start. So if you're lingering, why don't you go ahead and take a seat. And as chair of this session, I'll just remind you that if you have cell phones or other noisemakers, go ahead and turn those off so we won't distract from the presentation. And there's probably more things that I should say, but since it's at the end of the conference, I think you've heard them before. If you have questions, you can ask me or Mary Ellen. How's that? Afterwards. All right. So let me read a bio of Maggie, and this is, it's perhaps maybe just a little bit longer than some of the other bios that have been read at other sessions, but I think you'll enjoy it, and it will help contextualize what you're going to see today, so I'm going to go ahead and read this for you. Maggie is full of questions. What color is the wind? What shape is E equals MC squared? What does the inside of a thunderstorm look like? These ideas are just a few of the images dancing in her head. Her life is centered on her family, faith, and art. Her paintings and sculptures reveal explorations into landscapes of the mind and heart, reflections of the strength, adventure, beauty, and wisdom gleaned from the trials, joys, and uncertainties of life. Maggie has been an artist all her life. Her mother reports that she was born with a paintbrush in one hand and a chocolate bar in the other. She is a multidisciplinary artist. She makes her art using a wide variety of mediums, including oils, pencil, batik, watercolor, photography, and sewing. Her favorite medium is silk painting. She received her BA from BYU in 1986, and since then she's been painting and teaching wherever life takes her: Utah, Hawaii, Ecuador, New Jersey, Nevada, California, England, Illinois, and now in California once again. She specializes in teaching silk painting, and her curricula has a class for all ages and interest levels from 2 to 102. From a simple passing curiosity to the developing professional, Maggie's curricula include an art therapy class designed to help alleviate the pain and distress of a chronic illness, such as cancer, diabetes, chronic fatigue, and more. A survivor of Ewing sarcoma herself and an amputee, Maggie can attest to the healing power of art. Maggie listens to music and audiobooks while she paints. Rumor is she sings along loudly to her favorite rock bands, paints with her fingers, and often has to incorporate bits of half-melted chocolate into her paintings. Maggie currently lives in Claremont, California with her tall, dark, and handsome husband, Gary.
Is Gary here?
Yes. Gary?
Okay. Stranger.
And her three marvelous and precocious teenage children, Dominique, Stephen, and Justin. Capturing the opportunity of living next to the Claremont colleges, Maggie is seeking an MA focusing on an examination of the role of art in early Christianity.
Thank you. Let me do a quick change, PowerPoint. I woke up this morning feeling a little under the weather, so I probably won't be as vivacious as I usually am. And if you can't hear me, let me know. I tend to get quiet quite easily. It's said that it takes two people to paint a painting, one person to do all the work of painting the painting, and another person to come along, take the brushes away, and say, stop. Preparing this presentation has been exactly the same. And so I would like to say thank you to a couple of people who haven't been afraid to try to tell me the computer off, to turn my computer off and say, stop, and my friend Beth Tracy and my husband Gary. Now, alphabetic text is not my native language, if you will. I think in pictures. Talking about things, all things art or anything for that matter, is an act of translation for me. Establishing definitions helps keep a framework around the conversation, but that doesn't always mean I'm going to stick to my own definitions. As I prepared this presentation, I put text on the screen that I wasn't going to refer to in my paper. So I've asked Angela to read for me what she sees on the screen when it comes time. So I'm going to ask Angela to read the definitions.
Personal, of that pertaining to, characteristic of, and owned and by an individual, thoughts, feelings, actions born of the private, privileged, distinct, unique, idiosyncratic. Iconography, representation of an idea and or concept in a form that provides a context for the individual to access and interact with the idea and or concept of pertaining to religious concepts. Inner desert journey, Our real journey in life is interior. It is a matter of growth, of deepening, and of an event, and of an ever greater surrender to the creative action of love and grace in our hearts. Thomas Merton.
As you read in the program, I'm exploring the proposition that the intangible inner dialogue, the inner journey, that an individual engages in must find a way to be expressed in the material world. A tangible something must be created, an anchor that allows the strings of that inner dialogue to progress the individual's understanding of self in the material day-to-day activities of life. This is a process of adopting or co-opting existing expressions, trying them on for size, and changing them with the prevailing thoughts and forms of fashion and expression as they ebb and flow. Not unlike running amok in a costume shop. You get to run around trying on masks and costumes, acting out new ways of being, which leads to new ways of thinking and new ways of seeing. I want to quickly identify a few of the many modes of expression, the costumes, if you will, that all of us try on at some time or another. For me, obviously, doing art. Music is a costume. Sports. Sporting activities that involve a kinship with other creatures. Weaving. This man is a master weaver and turns his gift into keeping us well clothed and warm. Spinning, the wool that makes us, the weaver uses. Being a good farmer and caretaker in a business sense. In the professional field. Now, the radiologist who takes time to warm up the x-ray table with a warm blanket before I climb on it, that is a person who approaches their work as an art form. Believe me, and it's appreciated. The act of helping another person try on and experiment art forms. Being a mentor and a guide. And just hanging out with the boys. Oops. In the Christian experience, and specifically in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the relationship of the individual with God and all things divine is emphasized as the context for expressing both the inner journey and the exterior costume exchanges. I feel that the experience of discipleship is an explicit, individual, and personal responsibility. There is always lots of room for trying on the costumes. I personally feel that we don't delve into that experiential, vicarious learning process enough, and that can be looked at even more. But allowing that their cycle of growth has abundant room for playing dress-up, the LDS doctrine and the cultural emphasis on individual discipleship demands that there can be no standardized expressions of the interior journey, precisely because it is so personal. And that borrowing and adopting for yourself other people's expressions simply do not satisfy. Sooner or later, each individual must develop his or her personal iconography for expressing their experience. In my paper, in this presentation, I'm attempting to give voice to some of the musings on the subjects with images representing my glimpses of the inner dialogue of the inner dialogue form of visual art.
Impressions of what I think I see through the dust streaks and around the edges of the darkly glass, or the grammar of grace as art.
In the artist's vision, I need to quote these things. In his book, The Icon, Image and the Invisible, Aaron Snyder writes about the artist's vision and the role of the icon. He says, quote, In the artist's vision, the constituent elements of the work are so intimately knit together. I ask you to think of that process of knitting. So intimately knit together that they give birth to a new reality. This holds true for the icon as for every other work of art. Think of all the pictures that I just showed you. The icon, however, introduces another dimension into the image, transcendence, and thus projects itself beyond the forms of our world, making God's world present. The elements come together in this other world where they open themselves up into new ways of seeing things in faith and meditation. Close quote. That's pretty much the same as what I wrote on the slide, so we'll move ahead. Bell Hooks, in her work, in her book, Art on My Mind, Visual Politics, explains the act of experiencing art. And as I push the definition further, expressions of the inner journey. Quote, identification with art is a process, one that involves a number of different factors. First, recognition of the familiar. That is, we see in art something that resembles what we already know. And second, that we look with the received understanding that art is necessarily a terrain of defamiliarization. It may take what we see and know and make us look at it in a new way. Close quote. Here's a quick exercise. I want to ask you, what do you see? There's something familiar. Is there something about the image that causes destabilization and a dissonance from defamiliarization to happen within you? Does it evoke associations with things that aren't there in the image to begin with? And ultimately, it leads to a refamiliarization that proposes new realities, a new way of seeing things. So we have the reality of the space being in the image. What do we see there? There's stairs, shoes. Anybody see anything else?
I see a Gothic window shape.
Okay, but is that the reality of the space? It's not the reality. You got ahead. There's a now, you move ahead to the resemblance of something that's known but isn't really there. A Gothic window.
You're at the end, at the bottom, or at the top, or at the stuff, you know. Actually, I know what this is. But although I don't recall what that is at the bottom, so it looks like a cloud or maybe an opening in a cove, you know, where the light is? Or
a cloud, an opening into a cove or a window. Anything else?
Looks like space to me.
Outer space is what you mean? Mm-hmm. Going into outer space? Okay. None of those things are in the image to begin with, but did it lead you to new reality? Okay.
So you have to tell us what it is.
Well, first I'm going to do it this way. Do you see anything different now? Did the shift of perspective and point of view, it's the same image. Has it changed what you see?
There's actually people in it,
too. Yeah.
I didn't see those people before. And they're kind of in the middle.
A different points of view helps you see the real space better, that there are people in the image. Does it lead to a new perspective, a new associations?
It looks like a guy.
Yeah. An eye?
Like an eye.
What about now? Okay. So somebody asked what this really is. As an artistic experience, this is your inner dialogue finding conversation with an image that I created. So what it really is isn't as important. What's important is how it interfaced with your inner dialogue and progressed your conversation with your own to new realities. What it is it's looking over a stairway and taking a picture down a stairway, and those are my happy little snappy pink Converse. Okay. But now we have the question. Do these images and these costumes and these things that we do, are they icons for us, or do they become cliché? The whole point of spending time with a piece of art and expression of life is to eventually yield oneself to the possibilities of new ways of seeing. There is a danger in wrapping oneself up in comfortable expression, the danger of ignoring or even denying the self, an experience that does not satisfy. This is, again, a question of icon versus cliché. Are there any signs to let one know when this is happening? Is there something one can do to move past this stutter, this muting of the self in expressions that don't satisfy? I want you to look at these images. These are stunning images that touch the familiar and pull the heart through the unfamiliar and into transcendent new realities. An experience applying the correct use of dress-up that leaves the viewer forever changed, down to the very core of his soul, or at least they used to. I myself can't look at a picture of Starry Night by Vincent van Gogh without awe, anytime I see it. An awe at the intelligence of the artist, his knowledge of astronomy, how light behaves, and how he communicates the sense of relishing in the creation of a new reality, new possibilities for understanding oneself. And yet, You can find this image reproduced on t-shirts, okay, umbrellas, all right, baby bibs, coffee mugs, boxer shorts, even toilet tissue. Now, this is quite a different experience of wrapping oneself in the image. Rather than being a touchstone to provoke the individual forward into the potential of his own personal expression of new possibilities, the image has been hijacked as a shield, a misused costume, a mask, a co-opted expression that cannot satisfy. Artistic work produced within the context of the LDS culture is not immune to this phenomena. In this painting by LDS artist Walter Rain, we see a powerful image presenting a familiar story in a new reality. Yet, like Starry Night, overfamiliarity with the image is becoming, for some, a costume of faith rather than a doorway into new personal possibilities of discipleship. This shift profoundly limits and robs the image of its power, as well as cheapening the original experience of the artist that provoked the creation of the image in the first place. The name of this painting is called The Master's Hands, and this is the story of Christ healing the blind man. I have the happy circumstance this semester of being able to sit in on a class of contemplative philosophy, which is giving me lots and lots of new voices and new texts that I can use to talk about myself, lead myself to new realities. I also benefit from the research work of the professor and other students, that I get to take advantage of their research. Now, Ludwig Wittgenstein said, "The whole weight may be in the picture." The philosopher D.C. Phillips further explains this, quote, "It is of the utmost philosophical importance to recognize that for the believers, these pictures constitute truths, truths from which the essence of life's meaning, truths which form the essence of life's meaning for them. To ask someone whether he thinks these beliefs are true is not to ask him to produce evidence for them, but rather to ask him whether he can live by them, whether he can digest them, whether they constitute food for him," close quote. In other words, do they express the inner journey and do they satisfy? This is why we cannot ignore the responsibility to identify and develop tangible actions that create individual iconography, as I'm attempting to define it here. Actions and behaviors of discipleship that become the art of one's life. This is not to say that we can't or don't use the work of others in our own expressions of discipleship. On the contrary, it is impossible to function without doing so. We simply can't replace the expressions produced by others for the hard work of pursuing our own inner desert journey. I surround myself with images, abstractions that draw warmth from me or wrap me in loveliness. Paintings and poems are moments, capturing or seducing us when we are so vulnerable. These images are metaphors. This is my life, how I see and therefore am able to speak. Praise the spirits and the stars. There are others among us who allow us visions that we may converse one with another. Now, these are not my words. These are from a book of poems called Writing in Texas by Sange Tosake. As I mentioned in the beginning, talking about these things is an act of translation for me. I need the produce of other people's tangible expressions to help me anchor my own. I cannot share my inner desert with you, my inner desert journey with you, unless I am willing to acknowledge my weakness with words and texts and gratefully borrow the words of others. These borrowed words provide a context for my ideas, a touchstone that allows me to share them with you. This process in and of itself is a creative act that leads to uncovering new realities and new opportunities that we may converse one with another. It begs the question, if we don't move beyond the limits imposed by the masks of standardized expressions, can we even identify that there is a conversation taking place? What is the form of the dialogue? Do you know the texts? Are there other expressions, texts, icons, or discipleships? And would we even recognize them, these other formulas of living grace? So, okay, that's several questions. But all of them lead to one question. How?
And the kingdom of God is likened unto
a little child. Okay? So here is a little child painting the floor with powdered sugar. Can there be a sweeter text to revel in life's experience in? I'll leave it to you to explore other texts that speak of children and the framework of their inner desert journey. Suffice it to say that we are required to look to them as models and guides. Read the poem.
Monkey Dance. There is a monkey in me. He never hides. He is always out playing. He has dark eyes of black, like coal, and he has brown and white fur, like red-heeled knee socks. He oohs and awes like an audience. He lives in the vines of my brain and swings like a coin on a silver string. He makes me do the monkey dance. Ooh, 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 ah, ah. The monkey dance. Ooh, 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 ah, ah. The monkey dance.
Isn't that a wonderful expression of the inner desert journey from a child? Now, I've been teaching art on and off for over 25 years. I never tire of the authenticity, openness, and joy of watching a child engaged in the exploration of expression. He feels no risk in stating the obvious. Now, this isn't to say that being around kids doesn't make me tired. But I don't tire of what I learn from them. I would submit that there is nothing equal to the beauty of a child, the brightness of spirit, the spontaneity, the natural intelligence, that which Einstein called the holy curiosity of inquiry. It can be breathtaking to observe and a blessing to participate in.
I love art. I love art. It makes me feel ecstatic. It ignites my day. It can make my heart fill with sorrow, satisfaction, and joy. It can sweep away all my troubles and make me feel soothed. The colors make me want to scream and shout, to cry and smile, to dance and prance. I want to share my happiness with the world.
That was by Sophie, age 9. Again, no, I don't know that I could improve on the expression, the outer expression of an inner journey. David Napier, in his book, Foreign Bodies, tells us, quote, knowledge can exist in the absence of intellectualism, since much of what is worth knowing is quite literally self-evident. The self, in other words, becomes evident through visible demonstrations of its connectedness, close quote. You've just seen a few pictures that children are able to do this quite successfully.
I have long considered the creative impulse to be a visit, a thing of grace, perhaps, not commanded or owned so much as awaited, prepared for, a thing also of mystery.
The grammar of grace must be expressed in many forms, many texts, and many, many different kinds of conversations. Through teaching, I have learned that by following the example of the genuine obviousness of that a child allows in the expression of new realities to hit me, the child's innocence demonstrates how to participate in tangible expressions created by other people, as well as how to draw elements from other people's expressions into the activity in my own life. If we allow it, the outward expression of other people's inner journeys will become, among other things, a shoulder to rest your head on when you are sad or weary, a scent of summer roses on the passing breeze that uplifts and refreshes you during a day of hard work, the painting on a wall at work that creates the space you need to mourn the loss of a loved one, the joke you overhear on the way to finals that releases your test anxiety. Do we get the picture? Is the how and the why a bit clearer? As I said, observing children is an important part of understanding and giving expression to this grammar of grace. Doing so can help uncover manifold examples of making the inner desert journey tangible. Let's now quickly look at two non-examples, or how to turn your expressions and those of others you borrow into limiting masks and tired costumes that don't feed or satisfy.
Overheard at MAF breakout session. Young Ernest, gifted by God, wannabe LDS artist. I mean, I was born with this talent, so yeah, I know God wants me to be a great artist. So how do I mean, galleries just got to show my stuff. How do I get, like, you know, in? James E. Christensen, work, work, work. Technique, technique, technique. Pray, pray, pray. Laugh, laugh, laugh a lot at yourself. Oh, and yes, you are born with God-given talents, you and all the 30 trillion of God's other children. What have you done lately to help any of them get, you know, in? Orson Scott Card. Get a job. Change a diaper. Wash the dishes. Take your wife out on a date. Art is in how you live life. You have chosen the gospel, right? Well, get busy, dude. The gospel is the art of living life in service for other people.
I used to attend the Mormon Arts Festival, which is what MAF stands for, in the mid-90s when it was being held in Tucana, southern Utah. And one year, I did over here, and I get to observe this exchange. The young man followed James C. Christensen around between sessions for 3 days. And I'm assuming everybody knows who James C. Christensen is and Orson Scott Card. Okay. I was impressed by Brother Christensen's restraint, but finally, he was cornered by the young man at the refreshment table and responded with this kind of this approach of a gentle yet direct humor. Orson Scott Card, who was a bit more imposing, happened to be standing right behind James Christensen and at this moment joined in. It is his nature to be a little more direct. And yes, he did say, dude. James Christensen and Card point out that gifts are tools for discipleship. Is a twofold gift. Or to continue my metaphor, your toolkit is your own personal dialect of the grammar of grace and has two uses. One, to learn to live the gospel with individual responsibility and to serve others. In other words, you're already in. And the picture says, uploading Operation Reborn.
The curse of social media. I don't want to drive up to the pearly gates in a shiny sports car, wearing beautifully tailored clothes, my hair expertly coiffed, and with long, perfectly manicured fingernails. I want to drive up in a station wagon that has mud on the wheels from taking kids to scout camp. I want to be there with a smudge of peanut butter on my shirt for making sandwiches for sick neighbors' children. I want to be there with a little dirt under my fingernails from helping to weed someone's garden. I want to be there with children's sticky kisses on my cheeks and the tears of a friend on my shoulder. I want the Lord to know I was really here and that I really lived.
A couple of months ago, this quote swept around the email and the social media. It generated a little mini-storm of seemingly warm and fuzzy chatter. Out of curiosity, I lifted out a very unscientific sampling of 60 or so comments to examine. There were several that remarked on the uplifting and inspiring example seen in Marjorie Pay Hinckley's life. But by and large, the majority of the remarks, 70 to 80%, were singing a yearning, desperate, even despondent tune. I have no doubt that these people sincerely want to love and admire Marjorie Hinckley. However, the nature of their comments were more along the lines of, I'm not worthy. Oh, Marjorie's so special. She was married to a prophet. I can never be as good as Marjorie. She makes her own clothes. I'll never get as much dirt under my fingernails as she has under hers. The peanut butter smudge on her shirt must be more wholesome than mine. It's probably even organic. Her kids have more merit badges than mine do. I bet they were all Eagle Scouts by the time they were 12 and a half. Okay. I'm being a bit facetious, but you get the idea. Last night, I drew a cartoon, which I wasn't able to scan and get put into the picture, into my presentation. I'm sure you can pass it around. It's a picture of Marjorie winding her way up to the pearly gates in the distance. As she rounds the bend in the road, several women are blocking the road as part of a Relief Society activity. They are wearing Marjorie Pay Hinckley masks. They threateningly brandish freshly dug carrots, baby bottles, and spoons of medicines. One of them says to Marjorie, "This is a carjacking. Step away from the car and no one will get manicured." In this quote, Marjorie Pay Hinckley is trying to share with us a tangible expression of her inner desert journey, a journey devoted to love and service. The art form, the grammar of grace of her life, was to quietly tend to the needs of others in friendship. that the expression, that was the expression of her art. The only reason we even know about it is because she was married to a prophet. That she lived this way and being married to a prophet are mutually exclusive. There are many, many people that lived that way and we will never know about them. There is in the reality, there is a real reality in the experience of Marjorie Pay Hinckley's journey. But like Starry Night and Walter Raines, The Hands of the Master, it is being used as a costume that limits and binds and even blinds. The life experience of Marjorie Pay Hinckley is one that I think of as that uplifting smell of roses on the passing breeze. But my sad experiment with the bitter squall her quote stirred up on social media left the air more than a bit weighed down with the smell of decay.
It occurred to me that if one could make a people lose touch with their capacity to create, to lose sight of their will and their power to make art, then the work of subjugation is complete.
Both the young man at the Mormon Arts Festival and the semi-anonymous people in the social media experiment commenting about Marjorie Pay Hinckley that are grasping at the experience of the inner journey from a position of lack, the kind of lack that puts a muzzle on conversation and dims the vision required to view new realities and possibilities of grace and discipleship. In this quote, bell hooks is specifically referring to questions of gender and race as experienced in a post-colonial, post-slavery America. But I believe it applies very well to the broader context of my thesis, and it leads to the question, a subjugation by and to whom? To whom? Any suggestions?
Complacency.
Subjected by complacency?
Of course, I just jumped totally to something else. That made me think of the commercials that show you all the convenience food and fast food. And if we lose, you know, if we just like go into that, we lose sight of our will and our power to eat wonderfully, and the work of subjugation is complete.
And who are we subjugated to?
So, I don't have the answer for that.
Yeah.
But I do like the comment that you made earlier was very powerful to me, and I haven't seen this slide yet, so, and we haven't talked about it, so this is all new to me as well, about the fact that we're right in, right? So we're all these talented artists by the fact that we're alive and we're experiencing life. And are we running around trying to get our work in the gallery? The fact is, it's in the gallery. We are in the gallery. So to answer your question, maybe we're subjugating ourselves to ourselves for a false sense of pride or to this alter ego we've created is about who we're supposed to be as opposed to who we are.
So we're subjugated by corporation, subjugated to ourselves by a false definition of self.
And by anybody that just tells you what to do, and you're like, okay, if it's on the list somebody else gave me.
So the subjugation could be said in other words,
not
loss of agency.
But often, I don't know if loss of agency, but I would almost say we give it up.
Yeah, abdication.
Abdication of agency, because somebody really can't take away your agency.
No.
You just always have a choice.
Subjugation is an act of abdication.
Just as the car must be given gas to go forward, to take us where we want to go, the soul must be acknowledged, cultivated, and cared for, if we are to become self-realized human beings. I am not eccentric. I occupy the center and all the rest is bizarre.
This is a quote by Gennard Guttet, 1340 to 1384. He was the founder of the Monastery of the Common Life Brethren at Windelsheim. Quote, he who can lead an interior life and set little value on outward things need not seek a special place or await a special time to perform exterior things. Progress in the spiritual life does not consist in having the grace of interior consolation, but rather being able to bear with humility and patience the privation of it, so as not to grow lax in prayer, nor to neglect your other works which, according to your good custom, you are wont to perform, but rather so as to perform them to the best of your ability, not omitting them because of dryness or anxiety of heart. Close quote. I like that dryness and anxiety of heart bit. I have many, many more musings about all these things that I call the expression of the inner desert journey, the grammar of grace, and those things I see in the dark holy glass. The time is short, and you're no doubt more than ready for dinner. A tangible expression that is more to sure to satisfy more than listening to me carry on. Thank you for sharing this bit of conversation with me. So we have some time for questions, if you have any.
Can I ask one? Can you talk about a little bit about your process as an artist, like how inspiration hits, and like is it something you set aside like so many hours a day to work on art, or is it like when you're in the moment, it's just like, I don't know, like however it sort of tends to work for you?
Well, like I said, my mother will tell you that I was born with a paintbrush in my hand and candy bar, the other one. Art is a language. I do not think in words. It really is an act of translation. And I think the reason I talk like a textbook is because I have to work so hard at it that I've become, I have adopted or co-opted, perhaps, modes of expression along this line. But my processes of accessing images, I guess this presentation is one way of trying to explain that, of answer that question. Where do I get my ideas? I see them through the darkly glass, or through the glass darkly. I like saying the darkly glass. It's what I think I can see through the darkly glass. They're problem-solving experiments for me. It's pain management sometimes. It's also something that I would prefer to do than eat. So, and that's also, I think, is kind of a clue to what is your personal grammar of grace. If you're doing something that is more important than remembering that you've got to go eat, that is a clue that this is something that's part of your inner language. The processes that I use to actually create the things are obviously a skill set that I've learned over the years, partly molded by my environment. If I had been born in Holland 300 years ago, as a woman, I probably wouldn't be painting at all. But if I were painting, I would be, you know, trying to produce things that you see, like Rembrandt and stuff. That would be the fashion of the time.
I was just thinking, right? Unless your art form is cooking. But then I thought of my, I remember our middle son, he loves to cook. He was cooking a dish for them once. And we finished cooking it. All right, let's eat it. He said, no, I just wanted to cook. But I was wondering, do you think that people in general kind of find or fail to find time to figure out what their particular creative outlet is, or they work too much, or they're too caught up in television, or this and that, or do you think in general American population, people you've run, or maybe the LDS population, is a bit really can be solved?
I think there's overemphasis on if you were on the word talent, which is why I don't think I use the word at all in the entire presentation. You say the word talent, what automatically springs to mind? There's a very narrow category of things that qualify one as being talented. My point is that Marjorie Pay Hinckley lets dirty kids kiss her. Why is that not as important a talent as James C. Christensen? I think that James C. Christensen would tell you that Marjorie Pei is the more talented one. There's overemphasis on this narrowing of definitions, and then measuring ourselves against this definition. I think there's way too much measuring. And that, again, is one of my points. I don't measure myself or my art by Rembrandt. I'm actually looking forward to some time where I can take lessons from him. But for here and now, what a useless exercise to try to measure myself on the success of my talent by somebody else's. If I have this gift, and this is the way that I see things, and I believe that I'm a daughter of God and I am here for a purpose and have a reason, then this gift has two purposes. It's my tool to learn to live the gospel, to learn how to be a disciple. And in the mere act of doing that, I'm going to leave behind me a trail that becomes service for other people. That's all the two things. The lady who was talking in the seminar about the exponent kept on saying she doesn't write. She's the organizer. The writers probably couldn't make it happen. Where would they be without her? She cannot measure herself by the writers and the bloggers, and the writers and the bloggers would be destroying the whole project to try to measure themselves by her organizational skills. Is two sets of problem-solving skills that work together to create a new reality. And we spend too much time looking, and we wrap ourselves in the costumes, and then the costumes, they don't fit right, but we're afraid to take them off. And to pull an example from Hollywood recently, I think the meltdown of Britney Spears that has been so well chronicled over the past few years is an example of this. This is a child, and I think of her as a child, who is never given the opportunity to figure out what's going on inside her own head and her own heart, because her entire life has been an exercise in dressing up and being something that she's not. To where now she's supposedly an adult, and has no inner frame of reference, nothing to hang herself on internally, and she's just one meltdown after another. And I think we see that all around us. We're seeing many meltdowns. If we go to church on every Sunday, I can bet you that within the Relief Society room, there's probably a half a dozen meltdowns going on. But everybody's like, there. They're not, you know.
I am also disturbed by that question. When I ask women, because I interview them for our newsletter, and I say, so what else do you want to share? What talents do you have? And unfortunately, I use that term. And these women don't answer me. Well, I have six daughters, or I have this, or I have, you know. They don't come up with this greater understanding that talent is not singing, dancing, and, you know, painting.
Well, in the ancient, and you would know the translation of this better than I, Beth, but in fact, you were telling me what Tammy Snyder said. The word talent, as it applies to, say, painting pictures, didn't really begin to be applied to that particular activity or skill set till around about 1,000 years ago. So we've got another 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years of human experience where the concept of talent did not exist within the framework or the experience of being human. In the ancient world, in the Hebrew, somebody who was particularly gifted at something was called
an artist. I mean, wisdom. They were
wisdom.
Wise.
They were wise
in a skill.
In their skill set.
Whatever that skill set.
They were called wise men. So the person that was really, really good at keeping the flock from running away, off, that he was wise in the skill set of managing his sheep. The person who was really good at chiseling out the little designs on the side of the temple was wise in the craft of stonework. There was no, this term and the way that we use it, post-enlightenment, everything, it didn't exist. It wasn't part of the human experience to think that way. Now it is part of our human experience to think that way, which raises a question, how are we going to use that dissonance to create new possibilities and new realities? Instead of sitting there going, oh, I'm not worthy, I'll never be as talented as you. And whenever I hear that, there's this cheeky little voice in my head that wants to say, well, good, now that you figured that out, you know, you're right, you never will draw like me. Now that you figured that out, what are you going to go do for yourself? But if I really said that to somebody, you know, out of context of this little presentation, how would that be received? It would not go over well. But yet that's really what the issue is. Good for you. You have realized that the costume isn't fitting right. You had fun wearing it for a while. It doesn't work for you. Go find something else to do. Any other questions?
I thought your statement about if you had been born in Holland 300 years ago, that the way that you express yourself mm-hmm. would be different. How do we, in this world, I mean, we have so many different types of cultures and subcultures and all different things fighting for our attention. How do we express ourselves in ways that we are accepted, or ways that won't get us stoned or something?
Well, the first thing is your question there, being accepted. It doesn't matter whether you're accepted or not. That's not the question. What the question of your finding your express mode of expression is how you are expressing your inner dialogue for you, how it works as a problem-solving tool for you for this moment. Okay? That it ends up being something that somebody else can use is wonderful. But that shouldn't be, I don't think, shouldn't be your first criteria. I've got to do something that's going to be accepted. The form that my art takes is shaped by the environment. I grew up, as it were, most of the time, under a quilting frame. You know, the little old ladies would push the needle down and I'd crawl under and push it back up. I learned, you know, I grew like a weed and I was 5'8" by the time I was 12. Nothing, didn't have any clothes that could fit. I had to learn to make my own clothes. So sewing enters in a lot. A lot of my stuff ends up being in a textile form because that was part of my environment. Like I said, if I had been born extremely wealthy in Holland 300 years ago, I would have been working exclusively in oils on a canvas and maybe painting 3 paintings in my entire lifetime, because that's the way that the art, that visual art was approached at the time. I've been to Hawaii, lived in Hawaii, and there I watched these ladies there sitting there making their lays and stuff. So they harvest these flowers, and their fingers move so fast, and they make these lays. They're only going to last a day, but they're magnificent works of art, and it's a skill set that they've taken years to form.
And I think it's also important, like you said earlier, I think at the very beginning where you had all those different pictures, is to think outside the box on this particular topic right off the bat. I have a sister who is a magnificent musician. I can find middle C, and that's it on the piano. You know, and I have another sister who has home-taught all 4 of her kids, and I can't do that. I don't have the patience. It's awful for me. But I have other things, and I think we need to stop comparing ourselves to others. We also need to stop accepting the tried and true definition of things, like talent. What do you like to fill your days with? Mm-hmm. Maybe is a better idea than talent.
Yeah. One of my good friends, she's a reader. She plows through books and just reads and reads, and I know that every time I turn on Facebook and get a message from Susan, that I'm going to get a mini book review. And other people I know would look at it and go, oh, well, you know, she should be doing laundry or cleaning the kitchen or, you know, her kids are over there, you know, and she's holed up on the back porch with a glass of lemonade and a book. That's how, that is important to her, and that is the expression, ways that she is expressing her inner journey, is to this vicarious experience that I think we don't spend enough looking into. She's looking into that. She's spending time exploring the world vicariously. And then she shares that with people.
What time of day or what kind of process? Do you have a certain set of time during the day? You do this, or do you just
Been very, very haphazard. I have moved 11 times in the past 20 years. To have... Love you. To have a studio that I could set up and this be there would be wonderful. But I don't. So again, this forms, the artwork is shaped by the environment. So back there you see those sticks. I don't know, Beth, if you want to go grab one. I made those sitting, waiting for the kids at karate lesson, you know, karate lesson, music lesson. I had to take my studio with me, and this was a way to take the impulse, take the need, take the conversation with me wherever I went, and while I'm sitting there waiting for karate to get over, I'm making my art. Other times I have had a studio or a space, and then I was able to actually, you know, finish an oil painting. So it depends on where I'm living and where I'm at. Right now, we've just moved here, and we have a space that we've almost got set up that could be more or less of a proper studio. So the shorter version of that long answer is no, I don't have a set discipline, which I crave. I wish I did. Circumstances haven't allowed it, but... You'll never find me without my little book and my paper, and even post-it notes. Whatever I can find, I'm going to be doodling and drawing on. That is my problem-solving skill set. I'm going to do it because that's how I think, and that's how I find ways to organize feelings. It's like a mathematician. You're not going to go up to a mathematician. They're always going to be computing, you know, stuff in their head. It's the same process, but for me it's with visual imagery. With a cook, they're thinking in flavors and smells and textures and tastes. A carpenter is thinking along the lines of his skill set. But if we call this inner desert journey and how it's expressed, instead of calling it a talent or even a gift, if we call it a grammar, and I was suggesting a grammar of grace, because it's not something we've earned, it's something that's been given to us. If it's a grammar of grace, then it doesn't really matter how we come to it. And the outer form can be absolutely anything. And what I think is a fascinating question is how many other languages there are out there. How many dialects are there that we're not, because we're putting these restrictions on definitions of what talented means or what gifted means, how many people's voices are just being squashed? We have the meltdowns. Britney Spears has no voice. She cannot speak. Whatever God-given gift she was born with, she has no ability to access beyond what somebody else is, some costume somebody else has told her to put on. And if that's happening all around us, and I sense that it is when I, you know, go to church or I move in the circles I move in, you can kind of see it in people. It means that their dialect their grammar is not finding a way to be expressed or find expression. So their inner desert journey is something that they're going to go out into the desert and die, rather than it having it be a journey of illumination and rejoicing, which is in the context of what the inner desert journey is supposed to be.
So do you have any advice for folks who try to go about finding what our particular medium might be?
Well, a very practical tool that my father would tell people. My father was a psychiatrist. And so what he would tell people is just to keep a journal. Keep a journal of what you do every 10 or 15 minutes. So if you spent 10 minutes in the shower, or if you spend an hour in the shower when, you know, you really should have only taken 10, well, write that down. You like luxuriating in the warm water. It's not a judgment call. It is just you're getting a data dump. Keep a journal of what you do for every 10, 15 minutes for about a week, maybe 2 weeks. Absolutely against the rules to be passing any judgment on any of these activities. You are just getting it down. And then go back and observe. Try to attach a sensation of how you felt when you were in the shower for an hour. Were you stressed? Were you worried? Whatever. Did it feel good? Were you singing? You would be able to begin to tease out. There's going to be a thread in there that might help you tease out where your voice is, what your grammar is. And then what also is important to remember that, I was telling my husband earlier, that you might have two people that are absolutely the most fantastic bakers in the world. They both make outrageously scrumptious chocolate chip cookies. One baker is making them, he makes them, he puts them out, you buy them, fine, great, he's got money to go home and pay the bills. For the other baker, every cookie is a work of art. They're going to be baking those cookies whether there's anybody to eat them or not. For one, baking those cookies is an act of grace, an act of prayer. For the other, it's a job, he's doing it well, he's enjoying it, but it's not part of his grammar. Maybe his grammar is more, I've got a good business going. There's going to be something else behind that. But outwardly, it looks the same. You're not going to be able to tell the difference. It's because it's inside. It's inside their lives and their hearts. That's why with Marjorie Pay Hinckley, her activities, her grammar of grace to be these acts of service, it can be somebody else who's going and doing them, but they're doing them out of, okay, tick that off, tick that off, tick that off. But it looks the same. So outwardly, observers are going to look at that and not see the difference. The significant thing is going to be what's happening in it on the inside, and that's really not anybody's business. Unless it happens to be something like singing or dancing, and then it becomes more outward, and then we fall into that trap of comparing and measuring and that type of thing.
Thank you for reminding us that we are on this inner journey. It's easy to forget that. It's easy just to be doing whatever and thinking whatever we're being directed to do. I wasn't even thinking about it. Now I'm like, oh.
Thank you.
I'd like to know that my organizational skills are wicked in.
Oh, man. You have no idea. Yeah, best organization. I mean, there are all kinds of TV shows and movies and stuff that would never have happened if it hadn't been for Beth, but nobody's going to know that.
That's a lie, but okay.
Close enough. Well, it is 6:30, so if there aren't any more questions or comments, then I guess we're good. Thank you.
good you're making us do.
Thank you.